Welcome to the This Is Money podcast, brought to you in partnership with Charles Stanley Direct, the award-winning investment platform trusted by over 40,000 clients. Investment involves risk. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is reporter George Nixon. And coming up, Boris's state-backed 95% mortgage plan to turn generation rent into generation buy. A good idea, or exactly what we don't need. Talking of my favourite subject, house prices have boomed in lockdown. So is Britain's property market, like Wile E. Coyote or a cockroach that will survive anything. Meanwhile, the corona economy, it's growing, but not by as much as hoped. But there is more to the economy than GDP figures. So we take a look under the bonnet also today. What to do if you're an expat who's been told your account will be shut due to Brexit. And why are This Is Money readers so interested in the Klarna Xbox saga? Are they all secret shopaholic gamers? And don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, a grand plan by Boris Johnson to turn generation rent into generation buy, or yet more tinkering in the housing market that makes no difference at best and could actually make things worse. We heard exactly this before David Cameron using those very words 5 years ago, but the PM this time round wants to achieve his aim by boosting the availability of long-term mortgages for home buyers with a small deposit. He said up to 2 million people who could afford repayments cannot currently get home loans. All about deposits. Okay. Simon, what is the plan, first and foremost, before we get into what we think of it?
Well, we asked the Department of Housing about that after Boris's speech, and it turned out that details would be sent out in due course. More details would be sent out in due course, which makes you suspect that the question of what is the plan, the answer to which doesn't come with a great amount of depth. There is a plan, a vague plan, and it's to give people 95% mortgages on long-term fixed rates. Exactly how this would work and exactly how we would do this and the implications of it and the knock-on effects and the unintended consequences and the questions surrounding the fact that the real problem with the property market is that homes are too expensive and continually coming up with ideas that simply helps them continue to be too expensive is not possibly the best solution to the problem, is sort of being brushed under the carpet at the moment. But just to look at that kind of headline thing, the idea is that people would be able to buy a home with only a 5% deposit down, and the risk of doing that would be greatly mitigated by encouraging a long-term fixed rate mortgage market. So Britain's favourite mortgage rate is the 2-year fix. You fix at a low level for 2 years. At the end of that, your rate suddenly jumps up onto the lender's standard variable rate. The idea being that you remortgage at the end and you just keep going round and round in 2-year cycles. Coming up hot on the heels of the 2-year fixed rate mortgage is the 5-year fixed rate mortgage, which could possibly very soon become Britain's favourite mortgage. And that has the same principle, but you have an entire 5 years of knowing exactly what your payments are going to be and breathing space. And in all reality, a 5-year fixed rate mortgage for most people is probably a much better idea. Most people won't move home within 5 years. The risk is that maybe you fix at a higher rate than where interest rates are in 2 or 3 years' time. It's very difficult to see interest rates coming down any further than they have done at the moment, meaningfully so. Even if we went to negative rates, would mortgages get any cheaper? There's a bit of a question over that. But you do get the security of knowing what your payments are, and that's super, super important to people in case their circumstances change or it suddenly turns out that they can't really afford those payments. But actually, if you look to other countries, they have much longer fixed rates. If you take a hop over the channel to France and then quarantine for 2 weeks before you go out and look at the rates in the windows of the banks, you will find people fix their rates there for 20, 25 years. And that's commonplace. Whenever this has been brought up, it's been said, well, people don't want this in the UK. It's not going to be popular. It's been tried before. Nobody likes it. We don't go for it. We like our 2-year fixes, our 5-year fixes. What if you fix at the wrong point of the interest rate cycle? But, you know, you look at France and they seem to manage perfectly well with it. And in many other countries, they fix their rates for longer. You tend to have some kind of jump out or get out where you can get out of it. You don't end up with whacking great early repayment charges for those 25 years. But the great advantage of that is because you know what your payments are going to be, there is less risk in terms of you defaulting on your loan. And that's considered to be a less risky scenario, particularly for someone who is buying with only a 5% deposit. The problem is that banks don't really want to lend to people with 5% deposits at the moment. They don't really want to lend to people with 10% deposits. They pulled up the drawbridge on that one. Really, they want 15 or 20. They sort of blamed being really, really busy dealing with mortgage holidays, but that's not the most convincing excuse. Everyone thinks it's because they believe the house prices are going to fall. So the government would effectively end up underwriting some of this loan, which means that they would end up taking on some of the risk. So say, for example, the bank lends 85% and the government says, well, we'll top that up to 10%. And if this person defaults on their mortgage, which most people won't, so it's not a problem. If this person defaults on their mortgage, then we'll cover that extra 10% so that you're only taking 85% risk to the bank or building society. And that's probably about as deep as you can go with the idea because, as I said at the start of this, they haven't divulged the details after Boris's speech the other day, which I thought was a magnificently Boris Johnsonian speech where he sort of disappeared into a parody of himself at times. It sounded, at points I was listening to it and it just sounded like a random word association game involving wind turbines and things like that. It was like Boris goes mallets, mallet.
It might be. Do you remember at university, did you ever play this game where you had to get certain words like sheep into an essay? Did you ever do that? No, okay. That was just...
Apparently we're all going to retry... The bright new sunlit uplands where everyone's employed as a wind turbine maintenance engineer.
One of my best mates texted me after the speech. As a personal finance journalist, I'm now increasingly my group of mates, like financial advisor. and he... text me saying, you got any idea about this 95% 5% deposit mortgage plan that Boris Johnson's cooking up? And I said, no, to be honest. And no. It doesn't sound like he does really either.
Exactly. Well, can
George
I
George makes a good point there, right? Just to, sorry to jump in, which is there is an issue with this kind of stuff where politicians make these announcements increasingly without much to back stuff up, and it's a sort of it'll happen in the future kind of thing. But the way the rhetoric works is they do kind of indicate to people that this might be something that is imminent, and then it gets reported immediately because we live in an immediate world, and people like George's friend think, great, I can get a 95% mortgage. It's like, no. These things do not exist, okay, at the moment, and they may not exist for some time.
You say that like it's a revelation there, Simon, that, you know, politicians make, you know, dreams and promises. And I mentioned there about David Cameron using pretty much, I think he used exactly the same phrase 5 years ago, and I'm pretty confident there's been other politicians that have come before both of those that have said the same thing. Lay out for us why, when the plan back in 2015 was to turn generation rent into generation buy, we 5 years down the line, with Conservatives at the helm, and I'm not making this political point, I'm just saying, why we are still here where we need to make those claims?
Well, firstly, it should be pointed out that up until the coronavirus crisis hit, first-time buyer numbers were running at very, very high levels. So more and more people were managing to get onto the property ladder. And first-time buyer levels have been running at pretty high levels, back to sort of almost, you know, pre-financial crisis levels for maybe a year or so until this, you know, big crash and the lenders suddenly panicking hit. The issue is, of course, is that not everybody can join that party. And increasingly people are having to, you know, tap the bank of mum and dad or the bank of gran and granddad, or maybe jump into the sort of new build help to buy equity scheme where they tap the bank of taxpayer, but then sort of end up buying a new build, which is kind of a very expensive way of getting on the property market. And if you can't do any of those things, you're locked out because house prices are so high that saving a deposit is a very tall order. And this is true across the country. Obviously, house prices are most expensive in London and the South East, but it's also true compared to wages wherever you go. If you go up to the North East, where house prices are considerably lower, they're still very high compared to wages. It's just the wages are lower as well. And if you've got to save that deposit all by yourself, it'll take you a long time to save 10%. And I feel very sorry for anybody who has done that, only to discover that they've just about got to that 10%. And then all of a sudden, this crisis hits and now the banks want bigger deposits. Now, arguably, they could be doing you a favour. Maybe they're locking you out of the market at a time when house prices are going to fall. But for people in some parts of the country, it certainly won't feel like that, because we've got this lockdown property mini boom going on. Although it should be said that that is largely amongst more expensive family homes rather than the first time buyer properties. But there is a bit of a problem in that buy-to-let landlords chase the same properties as first time buyers. And there's some of them who are going out and buying because they're potentially getting, you know, quite a few thousand pounds off thanks to the stamp duty holiday. But I think if you go back to why we have a problem, it is simply that houses are too expensive compared to people's wages. But the problem is you don't make houses cheaper compared to people's wages by coming up with more and more ways to just keep bridging that gap and making it so that those house prices don't have to fall. Unfortunately, the only way you make house prices cheaper compared to people's wages is you either have people's wages go up by a decent amount and more than house prices. And we did have that for a while. Unfortunately, the gap is so big that it would take a considerable amount of time for that to happen. And I don't think it's going to happen now, not with what's been going on recently. Or you get the house prices to come down. And if you keep coming up with ways and means of lending people more cheap money, you will not have house prices come down. But we are unwilling to allow house prices to correct in this country. That has been demonstrated over the past 15 years, a complete unwillingness to allow house prices to properly correct.
I think that I've asked you about whether the government should stop tinkering in the housing market as many times as you have criticised Islington Council, Simon. It is many, for those who are not regular listeners. George, as the, dare I say it, it's true, the youngest among us, and therefore the one who is the first-time buyer, not that you are a first-time buyer at the moment, but I imagine that's what you're looking at, where do you see the big problems? What would really help? And also with the personal finance head on as well, what are the solutions?
First-time buyer eventually, maybe, Georgie. I did only just move out my parents' house 2 months ago. So, although that is a salient point I wanted to make, really, because I don't disagree with Simon whatsoever. I saw there was a tweet when after the stamp duty cut was announced in July, where Halifax said, first-time buyers can now benefit from a stamp duty holiday of up to £500,000. Now, the problem is that with all these disappearing low deposit mortgages that first-time buyers, like my friend, would take advantage of, because they've all disappeared, he worked out that for the average London house price, you'd need a first-time deposit of about £73,000.
Yeah.
So the stamp duty is not the problem. The £15,000 potential stamp duty savings is not the problem. It's the getting the deposit in the first place. I think it's true. I don't like this, the idea of this scheme, because it's much like Help to Buy, which was criticised as essentially inflating, helping prop up house prices, and was basically a massive kickback to developers who were encouraged to build, found really shonky homes. And the prices of those homes have since fallen, actually. I don't like this at all. It's a propping up of house prices rather than actually making house prices more accessible, simply by, as Simon said, pumping cheap money into the mortgage system and taxpayer propped up.
Simon, look, you've been speaking on past shows about the housing market having a Wile E. Coyote moment. Some stats out this week suggest that may be the case. Or is the property market, and in this is your words, but I rather like them, Simon, because I used to live in Thailand, and the little scratching sound, the cockroach, that just wouldn't die. It would survive anything. I mean, I've got cans of spray. God knows the damage I've done to my body, but that cockroach is still probably scuttling around somewhere in Thailand. Explain, what are you talking about?
Well, house prices are up 7.3% annually, according to the latest Halifax House Price Index. They are £17,000 higher than a year ago, the average house prices on the index. Now, I would take Halifax's index with a pinch of salt, because it's been rather over-optimistic in recent times. But it is a long-running index. It is very respected. It is based on its own mortgage approvals, just to be clear. But £17,000 higher than a year ago, the average house price. I mean, if you think back to, and this is for September, if you think back to September 2020 and all the madness that was ensuing, the worries over no deal Brexit and proroguing Parliament and will we, won't we get an election and everything like that, it did feel like Britain was, you know, falling apart at the seams. But it looks like an oasis of blissful calm compared to the same time this year, doesn't it? Oh, to go back, please. Yet somehow, despite all the completely crackers events of the past, you know, year, house prices have gone up, which, when you think about it, is completely mad. And to be honest, when the housing market reopened in May after being frozen initially in lockdown, nobody before that was going to happen. Well, there's like maybe like one or two people who were very much poo-pooed, who were optimistic about it. Everyone thought, right, this will be the thing that finally knocks the housing market in the UK on the head and house prices in the UK on the head. And lo and behold, there was a very brief sort of buyer's market where people could negotiate quite hard on stuff, deals they'd already done or stuff that was still on the market. And then things just suddenly flipped around, turned on their head. Estate agents started telling people that they were really busy. Everybody started going, ah, estate agents, they always talk things up. Then the mortgage brokers started saying, oh no, we're really busy as well. And they were like, yeah, you're talking up your own game again. Then it was the banks, like, you know, and it's like, oh, hang on, they can't make this stuff up. They're listed companies. And then the house price indices and the surveyors and everything. All of the evidence was, things were on the up. Rishi delivered his stamp duty holiday. Things went even more crackers over summer. And we are definitely seeing a property market mini boom. As I said earlier, not in all areas of the property market, largely in those areas of the property market that will benefit the most from the stamp duty holiday. But it all trickles down. It all mushes around in the housing market. And people seem to be very keen to get their move on in the middle of the worst recession in living memory, which is curious until you think about the fact that actually there's quite a few people who financially have not been affected. We talked last week on the podcast about the rise of the lockdown saver. But even if you're not saving lots of money and you're just sort of still trundling along as you were, then you won't have been financially affected. And lots of people do seem to have taken a decision based on two things. One, actually, I do want to move home, which, you know, once people decide that, they tend to actually act on it sometimes if they can. And two, I do want to try and save some money thanks to the stamp duty holiday. And as much as you tell me that I'll probably end up overpaying for a property and it'll all come out in the wash anyway, and I won't end up saving any money and the market will probably crash after the stamp duty holiday ends, I might as well try and move now when everybody's moving, because if I wait till the end of the stamp duty holiday, I might not be able to sell my house and then I won't be able to move anyway. So it's all, you know, it's all fun and games and let's move. And I know a number of people who are doing this who hadn't really expressed that much interest in moving before that point. So it is quite interesting. I would, as I said, take the figures with a pinch of salt, and the Nationwide Index shows prices up much less. Both of those are based on mortgage approvals. The ONS Index shows an even lesser rise in house prices, but that lags and some of that was delayed. So we only just got July's. Mm-hmm. But what was interesting is we got a RICS report from the Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors Estate Agents this week. And at the back of it, there's a big section where they get little quotes from their member estate agents. And it's always worth having a look through that, see what's going on in different parts of the country. And there was a number of people saying, yeah, things have slowed down. It was running at a very, very fast rate, but things have slowed down. People aren't quite so optimistic, particularly obviously in the local lockdown areas. But even other places, it's like, no, it's run its course. And we actually think things are going to get a lot tougher in the sort of next 6 months to a year.
What do you think, George? Have we been fooling ourselves? Have we been doing a little bit of a, this is a boutique, it's absolutely tiny, sort of estate agent language that we're using to massage some of this? Or, I mean, actually, we are getting the figures to prove that, as Simon said, there's been a boom, but are we just, is it the calm or the excitement before the storm that's inevitably coming? We had this with Brexit, didn't they? Well, do you remember George Osborne saying that house prices are going to fall 18% if we vote for Brexit? And we didn't. I think I said vote for breakfast there. If we vote for Brexit, I vote for breakfast every day. But George, what do you reckon?
Well, it's funny you made the point about George Osborne warning about house prices falling if we voted for Brexit. It goes back to my, I think, to my point about it being almost government policy to ensure that house prices keep rising. Because I think a lot of us sort of thought, a lot of us who were otherwise remain inclined might have thought, oh, that doesn't sound too bad. But I think it's impossible to look at, and we're going to come and talk a little bit about the corona economy. I feel like it's impossible to look at the state of the UK economy and where it's going to be in terms of people, the unemployment rates that we're going to see and that sort of thing, potentially if this second wave of coronavirus continues and hammers the economy still, that this surge in house prices can last. I wonder if it's kind of like we all took summer holidays and took some time off to kind of resume normality, like you say, the sort of calm before the storm. And also I feel like it's a subset of a particularly privileged part of the country of people who were in London, smaller accommodation in London, who are able to move out, take advantage of cheaper mortgage rates, the stamp duty holiday, and as Simon says, find those properties, family homes in the countryside. Really, I think it's a very small, within the grand scheme of things, a very small part of the housing market that's really benefiting at the moment, I would say. And I think it is a massive reaction to what's happened over the last 6 months, 7 months.
Yeah, and let's be honest, it's been quite some 6-7 months to react to. George, you spoke about the fact that you've been digging into some of the figures and the graphs a bit more, because we got some news about the UK economy this week, the corona economy. Continued its recovery in August, growing by 2.1%, thanks largely to the Eat Out to Help Out scheme. In normal circumstances, though, 2.1% would be considered rather good, but not so at this moment. Came in lower than expected, and the economy is still 9.2% smaller than before the pandemic struck. But there is more to the economy than GDP figures. So, George, you and This Is Money have compiled some charts to shed some light on the true impact of coronavirus so far. So what was the thinking behind this article, first of all? What were you trying to discover?
There has been a wider trend among economists in recent years to move away from solely looking at GDP as an objectively good or bad measure, because there's a lot that it misses out. But this isn't what that's about. That isn't what this is about. What this is about is simply that the economy is a very big thing, and looking at headline national output is not, you know, there's more to it. There's more to it than that. And whether it's good or bad is not quite it. It's an interesting way of looking at a snapshot of time during the heart of lockdown. You've talked about the massive amount that people were, more that people were saving, talked about record housing prices. And a couple of other things that we've had a look at, which really showed the impact of lockdown, was retail sales. So retail sales have bounced back. What we have seen is a real V-shaped recovery, in that they dramatically fell during the hard lockdown, but they have now bounced back to pre-coronavirus levels. But once you look in a bit more detail on that, the nature of the way in which we shop has completely changed. Footfall is still down, still below pre-coronavirus levels. It's doing better among smaller towns, market towns, and in regional places like that. But major city centre shopping streets, think Oxford Street, or indoor shopping centres, Bluewater, the Trafford Centre, etc. Those footfall there is way down on pre-coronavirus levels, because people are either shopping online or shopping locally. So that is a trend that, you know, was happening anyway, but has been dramatically accelerated by the pandemic. And indeed, the footfall data that is in this story, and I would, you know, definitely recommend people actually looking at the charts in person, whether on This Is Money or on the Office of National Statistics website, because it's very hard to visualize charts.
They work better, don't they, visually?
Exactly. So that's an interesting look at how we're shopping, and it's kind of good in some ways if spending has recovered, at least for the sake of the economy, if not for people's personal finances, if they're spending hundreds of pounds on clothes again that they weren't before. What is less good and far more concerning is the dramatic fall in how many hours
people were working. So by between the end of February and the end of June, the number of hours worked by people aged 16 or over had fallen by 200 million hours. So this has bounced back somewhat, but we are still working fewer hours each week as a country than we were at the end of 1996. This statistic from the ONS about collected total hours worked, which has been for 20 years on a massive upward scale and then absolutely collapsed as people were furloughed, as people were out of work, has been the chosen statistic of people who study the labour market, because you remember unemployment figures didn't really budge in April. You know, there was no tidal wave of unemployment from the outset. That's largely because, you know, close to 10 million people were on furlough and people were being supported. But what people have said and raised the question is whether that is the size of the post-furlough British labour market. That's the biggest worry, that we're going to see such a massive contraction in employment, millions of people left unemployed, and it's symbolised in that chart. And more recent statistics have found that redundancies are going up. Yeah. People are falling off payrolls, and younger people in particular, from my age bracket, are particularly affected, which is really quite worrying.
I think that's been one of the confusing things for people. They're talking about all these sort of job losses and impending doom, et cetera, et cetera. But we've not quite seen them borne out in the statistics. But it's a lag, I imagine, anyway.
Yeah.
And also, we've still got the furlough scheme. That does end at the end of this month. And sadly, redundancy processes do take, you know, for a certain amount, number of redundancies, 30 and 45 days. So I guess sort of don't hold your breath with
exactly. It's going to get worse, and that's why something like this was as useful. And the things happened. The Resolution Foundation has said the worst of this job crisis could be yet to come. I mean, people, those average work figures have recovered and will recover when the next raft of stats are released, I believe, in a week or so's time, when they show how many people went back to work in August. But, you know, hundreds of Britain's largest companies have announced thousands of job losses, and entire industries will shrink. And the point is that there's been a lot of talk about post-coronavirus viability and supporting businesses, supporting any viable businesses. But we're still in the midst of the pandemic. People have made this point that we still don't know what a post-coronavirus economy looks like, because we're still in the midst of it. So indeed, unfortunately, there's not a lot of cause for optimism at this stage in terms of those labour market figures, even if the GDP is slowly recovering.
Yes, I mean, we won't go down the sort of whys and wherefores and policy decisions and the lack of data and all these sorts of things, et cetera, because we've done that in podcast bars, and I'm sure we'll do it in podcast future. What I will say, though, Simon, is if you look at the figures, we've got that sort of V shape that people are talking about, a bit of a skew at the one end, but, you know, so that's good news, isn't it?
It's got a bit wonky at the end, the old V.
Yeah.
And that's 1 month. Monthly figures are obviously volatile. But if I can draw a picture in your mind of those listening, and if you just come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast, you can find all the charts themselves. Basically, the GDP graph looks like a sudden precipitous drop, followed by a sudden line that then rockets straight back up in the air. It gets about halfway, and then it's, instead of continuing on its trajectory of going pretty much straight back up in the air, it's done this little sort of wonky move to the right. Now, it might then just continue to go up at such a rapid pace, because even 2.1% in a month is, if 2.1% in a year would be considered not too bad, actually, pre-coronavirus. So 2.1% in a month is astonishing. But it might continue to flatten off. And I mean, you know, without going into the whole politics of coronavirus and restrictions and lockdowns and all that kind of stuff, I'm looking at a map here and a story. You know, heat map reveals the 200 towns and cities with high COVID-19 rates that could face three-tier lockdown next week. This is this traffic light system.
Yeah.
I'm looking at a lot of red on this map. I'm looking at the whole of the north of England, apart from like some little yellow patches, is in red. but there is red spread across the southeast of the country as well. London is all red, and the commuter belt, a lot of the commuter belt is all red. And we are talking here, if these stories are correct about these traffic lights, red tier three, all the restrictions from other tiers, which is basically what the stuff that's going on now, social distancing, rule of six, 10 o'clock pub closing, plus ban on households mixing, upgraded advice on face masks, God knows what that is, schools stay open. But red tier three is pubs, restaurants and other hospitality businesses shut. Restrictions on non-essential travel. That's stay home, in other words. Schools stay open. I mean, you chuck a big chunk of the country back into that and you are going to see GDP fall again. There's the V-shaped recovery, I think, has been predicated on a right, let's get life back to normal. We've had had enough of this stuff. Some people have got a bit more money. They wanted to go out and spend on big ticket stuff. But just look at what happened in August with people. Just a lot of that August stuff was hospitality, and it wasn't just Eat Out to Help Out. It was people going, I want to go away this summer, and I'm going to go away in the UK. You couldn't get a place to stay in the UK for love nor money in August if you hadn't booked it months in advance. People were going away. They were going out. They were spending money. Money was going around the economy. And that is going to, if it has not already been brought to an abrupt halt by the local lockdown stuff, which is covering a lot of the country, this traffic light thing will, and the map of red that I'm looking at, if it affects all those red places on that map, it will definitely call time on the V-shaped recovery for now. I can't see any way it would manage to continue, however much internet shopping people do.
Simon, just very briefly, I said I wouldn't go down to politics, but I can't resist because there's been a lot of talk about Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson having a contretemps, do we say, call it that? But is the mood slightly shifting a little bit on this? Is this sort of, I just think about the mayor of Middlesbrough saying, nope, we're not doing this. And you think, well, yeah, you are. Are we sort of losing it a little bit?
I don't know. I keep reading stories that feature polls telling me that the majority of people want to be locked down or want harsher restrictions. So I don't know. I would have thought that the mood is changing, but maybe the mood is just changing, you know, in parts, you know, and people exist in echo chambers, don't they? The mood has certainly changed amongst a lot of the people I know. Yeah. But, you know, that doesn't mean that those polls are wrong. I don't really know what we do now. I mean, it does appear that, you know, the cases are rising, you know, inexorably, and things are running
irrespective
out
of new restrictions.
Irrespective of the measures that we've put in place. I think, so I'm not really sure what we do, whether we try to slam the brakes on it again with some kind of, because the only way of slamming the brakes on it is with a really, really severe lockdown is the problem. And twice is probably the maximum you can get away with it. There's a very interesting interview with the Swedish health chief in the FT a few weeks back. Google it, read it, because it's free to read. And it's not uncritical of him. It's actually quite critical of him. So it's not sort of just, you know, blowing puffs of smoke about how wonderful Sweden is. It's not some mania like that. But he has to make some interesting points in there about needing to have a long-term approach to this, that this is not a problem that's going away. There is no magic bullet. Even if there's a vaccine, it takes a couple of years, and it takes a couple of years to roll it out, and that you can't just keep going back in and out of lockdown, because every time you do it, you lose people, it loses more effect, people get confused. And I don't know how successful a second national lockdown would be, even if it was only for 2 weeks, particularly if it was for a few months. But the measures at the moment, you know, I do see people paying attention to the measures. I don't see people not wearing face masks. I see stories of people going, oh, I saw these people in the shop not wearing a face mask. 98% of the people that I see are wearing face masks. 98% of the people I see are abiding by the rule of six, or if they're not doing it, they're doing it with only a couple of extra people, and they're doing it very, very subtly. You know, the vast majority of people I see are behaving perfectly sensibly. But if you want to do what they want to do and suddenly stop infections rising, the only way to do it is like the lockdown that we had before. And I don't want that. You know, I certainly don't want that, and I don't think it's a good idea, but I really don't know what we do. I do know that we totally stuffed it up. The period through summer when we had low cases, when we could have really got on top of things and planned for this, we totally stuffed up. And I just find that hugely disappointing. And and the fact that we are staring down the barrel of another lockdown just indicates the complete failure to deal with this, you know, properly. But I know who would have done a good job. It's very difficult to know. I would hate to be making those decisions. But I do know that they are really, really worried about this. And whatever measures they, unless they suddenly change their minds and go, we're going to have a totally different Swedish style approach, the measures that they bring in are definitely going to knock that V-shaped recovery on the head.
I had just had a vision there of what it's like being your daughter. I'm not angry. I'm just disappointed. Can I just also point out to those people that vote that they want to stay in lockdown, they enjoy lockdown, I'm still yet to sell my cross trainer for the podcast listeners. It's behind me and I'm pointing at it so George and Simon can see it. It's still here. So you lockdown lovers, there's a cross trainer in it for you. Anyway, we can leave this to one side because I'm sure we will talk about it many times in the future. But I want to talk about British expats. Now, we've been hearing for a while, they've been getting letters from their banks telling them that their UK current accounts and credit cards will be closed after Brexit unless they can prove that they have an address here in the UK. Now, it's affecting a proportion of the 1.3 million UK citizens that are living in the EU. So not all of them, but thousands of them, including some of the most popular destinations, including Spain, France and Portugal. Now, the accounts will be closed after EU-wide financial passporting rules expire after the 31st of December. Now, George, you've been looking into this and what you can do if you are in this situation. But first of all, what is happening? What is passporting?
So passporting has basically acted as a kind of regulatory umbrella which allows for a UK-registered bank, for example, to provide services across the EU just by virtue of being registered in one EU member state. So curiously, to use an example, a couple of fintech companies, which we'll probably come on to talk about as possible solutions, have banking licenses with EU countries like, for example, Belgium. So a company called TransferWise, which is a cross-border currency conversion service, that has a banking license in Belgium, which means that it can operate across the EU after Brexit anyway, because it's also got a UK banking license. Now, essentially, the end of passporting after Brexit leaves banks reliant on local regulations. So they would have to be approved, regulatorily approved, across all the EU countries that they want to operate in. And in many cases, these restrictions that they would have to comply with have proven too restrictive. Now, this differs across countries. It differs even within different banks' offerings. So this is why you can see that a bank like Lloyds is no longer going to be able to offer business accounts in Germany and personal current accounts in Slovakia. So as two examples, I've been told that in many instances, the banks are essentially unable to operate because what would happen is they would have to set up full operations in those countries and get become fully licensed of their own accord. And this has been described as a postcode lottery because in some countries, the banks may take the decision that it's too costly to comply with these regulations and to set up operations given how many customers they may have. Now, how many people are affected? Thousands. We don't know specifics because the banks won't tell us. With the exception of Lloyds, we know that around 12,000 Lloyds customers across the EU will be affected. There are 1.3 million UK expats in the EU, or it was estimated that there were last year. And although not all of them will be affected, those in really popular destinations like Spain, Portugal, yeah, France, Belgium, the Netherlands, have all received letters from one or more banks saying that their credit cards, for example, are going to be closed down after December the 31st.
Okay, why does this really matter?
It's a good question.
If you're living abroad, well, you're living abroad, right? Go have a bank account there, no?
Yeah, it's a question. It's a question that I sort of wondered when I started seeing this news, because I was in a bit of a funk about it as well, wondering the question and the answer. Predominantly is pensions. A lot of expats will choose to provide UK bank details that they still have from the time they lived in the UK to the Department for Work and Pensions to get their state pension paid into, so they can convert it over at a time of their choosing. And many will simply just keep it open to maintain ties. It can be, if you've lived away from a country for 5 years and then you come back, it can be very hard to get set up again.
Yeah.
To leave, so you can leave it open as a kind of credit footprint just to keep ties to the country. And then there might be some other reasons as well why they might want to keep it open if they receive investments or savings or some kind of income in pounds.
So what can you do? What's the best options that you have available to you if this is what's happening to you? And we should point out that we said that there's, you know, 1.3 million people, UK citizens living abroad. This will not affect everyone, but no. What can you do if this does affect you?
Exactly. And this is what we really wanted to answer in the story. Now, those who are affected should know by now that they're going to be affected. So they should have at least more than 2 months' notice to make alternative arrangements and come up with a plan of what they're going to do next if their account's going to be closed. Now, there are three options, but really there are only two, because one of those is opening a local bank account, and the chances are you'll have one already if you live abroad, and that account may well be in local currency, which is not much use if you want a sterling account. So there are a couple of options. One is, the major one is try another UK bank. Maybe an option, because not all banks are pulling out of all EU member states.
So at the moment, I think HSBC, you pointed out, are still good to go.
HSBC are under some EU payment regulations. You are legally entitled to access to what is known as a basic bank account, which may not have an overdraft. It may just be a simple, really basic, straightforward current account. You are legally entitled to one of those in the country in which you live. So NatWest, for example, told us that is one potential option for EU expats. And then the second option is using a digital money provider or a currency conversion service which provides banking details. So we go into this a lot more detail in the story, which I would advise anyone to read. But I mentioned TransferWise before. TransferWise is one, MoneyCorp is another, Revolut is a third. These currency conversion services offer banking details, which you can provide to the DWP or a private pensions provider or anyone else. It's worth noting these accounts aren't in your name. They usually just give them a number. That's an important thing to note. But they are one option as well, because they also tend to offer a better rate on currency conversions, which is often the best option if you want a UK home for you to pay in pounds and then convert it over and send it to yourself if you need it in your local currency.
So plenty in that. Do read the article, as George says. But now, we've spoken about Klarna before, Simon, but gamers. Now, that's something I don't think we've ever mentioned on the podcast before. Now, they've been trying to pre-order the new Xbox. I've heard of an Xbox. I'm very proud of myself. Using the Buy Now, Pay Later service. Having finally heard, though, after 2 weeks of being completely in the dark about what the heck is going on, if they want it, they've now heard that they will have to pay for it in one go after all when it is released. So there was also a blow for those who had hard credit checks run on them. They'd been told a direct debit had been set up with Klarna to pay for the Xbox over 2 years, and they got emails this week saying that's not going to be the case, but they've still had hard checks on them, and therefore I imagine it can impact your credit rating. What is going on here, and why do you think this has proved so popular as an article with your readers, Simon? What is Klarna, first of all? Remind us.
Well, Klarna is a way of paying for spreading the payments for stuff over a period of time. And it's become very, very popular and risen dramatically in its usage in recent years. And there's a couple of other companies that do this. Essentially, so say, for example, you could spread your payments, spread the cost of buying something like an Xbox, which is expensive, over 3 or 5 payments. And they'll even offer you the opportunity to do it interest-free. Mm-hmm. Which is a no-brainer if you think, right, well, I've got this money, I can have this money, I can pay it off over that, interest-free, I don't charge any interest. The risk is that you somehow don't make one of the payments, you fall behind or whatever, and then it stops being a no-brainer and you end up with a problem. But the way that Klarna manages to offer these interest-free payments to people is that it charges the retailers. So the retailers, astonishingly, retailers are so desperate to sell stuff to people that they will fund interest-free purchases for them. And, you know, Klarna goes to retailers and says, look, you offer people Klarna, or any of the other companies do this, same thing. You offer people our buy now, pay later, or buy now, spread it out over an installment service, your sales will go up. We've seen this with our other partners. Their sales have gone up. Your sales will go up. So it's hugely popular. So we've got a combination of Klarna here, with people being able to spread the payments for their Xbox, which is an expensive thing, and something that is extremely popular, the Xbox, and something that people really, really, really want to get their hands on as soon as it comes out, the Xbox. And then we have a big problem that George can explain in more detail. Lots of people tried to take advantage of what seemed like a great offer, and then it all came crashing down around their heads, and they ended up going round and round in circles for quite a long period of time. And they're going to struggle to get their Xboxes.
George? There are several points to this. Curiously, you mentioned about our readers secretly being lovers of buy now, pay later services and games consoles. I suspect from some of the comments that we've read in the stories that that our readers may not be aware, huge fans of either of these. But it's an important tale because it's indicative of the continued rise of Klarna, which is Europe's most valuable fintech company, the buy now, pay later service. It's also an industry that's becoming under increasing scrutiny from regulators over concerns that they're luring people into debt. The debt might be interest-free, but it's still debt. It still needs to be paid. Mm-hmm. Now, what you have is Klarna partnered with Game and Smith's Toys to offer the new Xbox under a bundle, which would see people pay either £21 or £29 a month for 2 years. Now, it's important to know that lots of people who got in touch with me about this story said that they would have been more than happy to pay for it up front. What it was it was simply worked out cheaper over the long run, and it was quite a good deal that was being offered. This was under something called Xbox All Access that would be paid for by Klarna. Klarna offers three ways of paying. Only one of these, which is its financing agreement product, which is what was in this instance, requires a hard credit check. Now, what happened was on Tuesday, the 22nd of September, the pre-orders for the new Xbox were supposed to be put on sale on Game and Smith's Toys. Now, the problem was the websites initially crashed and were down for hours, as is what always happens, it seems, when there is massive demand for something on the internet. Something goes wrong. What happened after that was essentially Smith's and Game and Klarna underestimated the demand for the console that there would be, and the console was oversold. Now, what this meant was that people who tried to check out when they were trying to purchase this were given a technical error message when they tried to check out, which meant that they were unable to complete their orders because the consoles were out of stock. However, Klarna still ran credit checks on these people, which meant people were getting hard credit checked for consoles that they couldn't buy. And then people were sent emails confirming that they had a direct debit set up with Klarna. It's important to note at this point that no one lost any money as a result of this. No money was ever taken out from these direct debits. It was merely set up on people's bank accounts. Then after this mess, loads of people were trying to get in touch with Klarna and with the retailers to work out where they stood with this, because they said, you've credit checked me. You've told me I have a direct debit. Where is my console? And a lot of people, especially from Smiths, were promised. We don't know any hard numbers on this because Klarna refuses to tell us, but we would imagine it would be thousands of people. They say a small number of customers, but given the demand for this, probably thousands. Now, they were left in the dark for more than a week before they actually heard anything. Early next week turned into Wednesday. And on Wednesday, they were told that actually, when they said they would be given a console, they have been sent these emails by mistake. Now, Klarna has issued a final update where it says that those people should not actually have been told that they were approved for a console. And instead, anyone who received that direct debit email, but no confirmation that their order had been completed, does not have one and will have to try again at a later point, either with Klarna, which, given the ordeal these people have gone through, is probably unlikely, or just buy it up front. A small number of Smith's Toys customers who were wrongly emailed saying a console would be there for them have been told the console will be there for them, but they have to pay for it in full on the day. Basically, the entire credit approval process has been a complete mess, and people will now actually have to pay for it up front, after all, in full. Meaning the whole last few weeks of trying to go through a credit check with Klarna for financing has basically just been entirely wasted.
And I imagine we all know, if you have
credit checks, hard credit checks, many in one time, it can impact on your credit score. I mean, this could have some repercussions, which are more than just you're not going to, and this is serious, I understand, you're not going to get an Xbox. I mean, poof. But it could be more than that.
Yeah, some people have reported that their credit scores have been damaged as a result of this. Many people still have hard credit checks on their files from Klarna for financing that they were never actually approved for. Worth noting, they weren't actually rejected for it either. It was just never approved. This is still just sitting there. Now, Klarna has resolved that it has checked through every single application made since the 22nd of September and will remove these credit checks by the 16th of October for anyone who wasn't actually approved for financing. Right. Hopefully leaving their reports and scores squeaky clean.
Well, let's hope so. Let's hope so. And let's hope that all those people that want their Xbox are happily with their Xbox over Christmas and any lockdown measures that may come. And if you want a cross trainer, it's yours too. And you don't have to worry about any kind of hard credit checks or anything. It's yours. Anyway, that's it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney. You can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast, where you will find all the podcast articles past and also the stories that we've featured in today's episode. And also come to thisismoney.co.uk/game to play our share picking game. We've given out three £500 weekly prizes so far for the best share picks. You can still play for the £15,000 jackpot. You've got until the 25th of October to get six share picks in. Do it. It's fun. And you might win some money.
Do indeed. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us. So This Is Money podcast is brought to you with Charles Stanley Direct. Open an account today and start saving for your future. Investment involves risk.